Welcome to the First Century Church Podcast. My name is Stephen Wilhoy, and I'm the lead pastor at First Century Church, and it is an honor to have you with us today. The goal of the podcast is simple. We want you to be encouraged, challenged, and inspired to go further in your faith than ever before. If you'd like more information about the church, you can visit our website, firstcenturykc.com. And if you happen to be in the Kansas City area anytime soon, we'd love to have you join us for one of our live gatherings to connect with you in person. Again, thanks for joining us today, and we hope that you enjoy today's message. So we're going to continue. We're going to motor through this series complex. This is week 12 as we're working through the Old Testament book of Job. We're still in a section in Job chapters 9 and 10 today where Job is responding to his second of three friends who have basically told their view of who God is and what he does. And we've looked at the last couple of weeks why his friend is off, and he's declared that. So today's a bit of a continuation of last week. If I'd had enough room to put it all in one, I would have, but I didn't. And so we're going to sort of finish up his thought in a different way. So we looked at Job chapters 9 and 10 last week in more of a philosophical lens. We looked sort of more high-end thoughts about Job's response to his friend here, Bildad. And so this week, we're going to look at the same chapters 9 and 10, some different parts of it, but we're going to look at a more practical level. And so last week, we looked at what we call the problem of evil, or it's called theodicy, and we looked at four arguments against God's goodness, and we tried to, I think, fairly successfully refute those to show that God is indeed great and he is good. And so on a practical level, we're going to look at the same sort of idea, but how it affects us more day to day. And what we're going to do is Job is, as we know, suffering a great deal. He's experienced unimaginable loss, and now he's going through unimaginable personal, physical pain, mental anguish, and really spiritual anguish. But the way that he has chosen to view and express and approach this suffering is what's helping him to endure it. And so what I want us to do is look at what he's looking at in the way he's looking at it so that we also can endure any suffering that we might face. And I think the main way we're going to phrase this and frame this today is Job is seeing his suffering, and I want us to see our suffering as sanctifying suffering. Sanctifying suffering. So it doesn't take much for us to recognize the negative parts of suffering, right? They're pretty evident. You know when things are wrong or when things are bad or when things are going worse or when you're in more pain. Like, those are obvious things. No one needs any help on defining those types of things. They're self-evident. But what I want us to look at today is see positive aspects of these negative things. Now, I'm not just going to be pie in the sky. We've avoided that, I think, successfully so far in the series. We're not going to ignore reality. We're not going to say those things that are happening aren't happening. That's not helpful. It might, for a short time, a period of time, you can fool yourself, but then you suffer long enough, hard enough, and that just doesn't work anymore, so it's not a good strategy. But we are going to see sanctifying suffering. We're going to look at five principles today that Job looks at. There were seven. I cut it down to five, so anyway, we'll see if we can get through it today. There are five sanctifying principles of suffering that Job sees, and I want us to see as well. So let's just hop right into it and see how we can view our suffering in this sanctifying way. Here's principle number one. God is seen more clearly in the presence of suffering, not less. God is seen more clearly in the presence of suffering, not less. Now, this is somewhat subtle that Job is sort of starting to flesh out, but look it with me at the beginning of Job chapter 10. He's going to show us something here that points to this idea, and we'll see how it applies to our lives as well, too. So Job chapter 10, verses 1 and 2, here is Job's, the middle of his response in this chapter. He says, I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. But look what he says. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. So again, in all of this pain and suffering and loss, Job is still looking to God. He sees God maybe even more clearly now than he did weeks or months ago before all of his tragedy befell him. He says, I will say to God. An interesting thing that we need to see, and hopefully you have seen this, and maybe I've not explained it well enough, but a lot of Job's response is a mix between talking directly to his friends briefly, and then a lot of what he says after that is more of a prayer to God. He even says it here, I will say to God, why do you contend against me? So even in his complaint, it's directed as a prayer to God. That's why in all that he says, even at the beginning in chapters 1 and 2, he hasn't spoken incorrectly against God. And when he's trying to correct his friends, what he says is right. When he addresses his grief and his pain to God, he's right in doing that. As we'll see at the very end of this book, when God speaks, God's the last person to speak, and he acknowledges that Job has done the right thing. Even though he said some crazy stuff, and maybe even you would think accused God of some things, God's like, you're directing it to me, and I can take it, and that's what I want. I want that dialogue with you. And so that's why he can see this as sanctifying suffering. It's an honest, raw, out loud sort of prayer. We looked last week at a quote. I'm going to come back to it because I want us to see the other side of it. I told you we'd do this. So Sam Harris, about 15 years ago, wrote this work, Letter to a Christian Nation. And he's a very famous atheist, you know, public intellectual. And his argument in being an atheist against God's existence is because of the existence of suffering and evil in the world. So look at it again. Here's what he says. He writes this. If God exists, either he can do nothing to stop calamities or he doesn't care to. God is therefore either weak or evil himself. There is another possibility, of course, and it is the most reasonable. The biblical God is a fiction, like Zeus and the thousands of other dead gods who most sane human beings now ignore. So his reasoning is, if God is so great and so good, basically the universe should just be rainbows and unicorns all the time. Now, this guy's smart, but that's a really dumb thing to say. That's a really stupid way to live your life. If God is real, nothing bad will ever happen. Well, people have been around forever. God's been around for longer than that, we would say, and it's still bad things still happen, negative things, suffering still happens. So on the opposite end of that, American Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga, he writes this in his book, Warranted Christian Belief. It's a little bit longer of a quote, but I want you to hear what he says to really answer this original argument. He says this, could there be any such thing as horrifying wickedness if there were no God and we just evolved? I don't see how. There can be such a thing only if there is a way that rational creatures are supposed to live. He goes on to say this, a secular way of looking at the world, like Sam Harris does, has no place for genuine moral obligation of any sort, and thus no way to say there is such thing as wickedness. Accordingly, if you think there really is such a thing as wickedness, then you have a powerful argument for the reality of God. So one of the faulty premises of atheism as a worldview is logically it leaves no room for morality to exist. Where did that come from? It didn't just evolve through biology. We didn't just come from the apes and now we have moral reasoning and we have basis for knowing right and wrong. It was implanted in us by some higher power. There's no basis in atheism for morality, even though every atheist lives within the context of morality. They like morality, they want morality, but they can't explain it in their worldview apart from God. And so Plantinga also, he underscores something that we touched on last week in his quote here, that evil is not a thing in and of itself. The idea or the prospect of an evil thing is the deprivation or corruption of an already existing good thing. So everything that God made was made good, and some outside force corrupted those good things through sin, through disobedience, whatever you want to say or however you want to explain that. But evil didn't just pop up out of nowhere. It evolved from the deprivation or the corruption of a good thing. And that's what he's saying here too, that something good had to exist first in order for evil then to come alongside it and affect that. So this points to an eternal being. This points to a good God who made all things and made all things good, and then the corruption of creation introduces evil and wickedness into the universe. Now, again, I know that's a little more philosophical. I thought we were going practical here. Here's on a more practical level how we can see this in action in our lives, how we can know I can see God more clearly through suffering, not less clear. So another separate quote from a guy we looked at last week as well, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, this 18th century German philosopher. He writes this, and there's a practical application that we'll look at here in just a second. Here's what he says. A little acid, sharpness, or bitterness is often more pleasing than sugar. There's a balance there, right? Shadows enhance colors, and even a dissonance in the right place gives relief to harmony. Then he says this, do men relish health enough or thank God for it without having ever been sick? And is it not most often necessary that a little evil render the good more discernible, that is to say, greater? He's making the same argument here. He's like, colors are made more vibrant through shadow. It's the dark thing, it's the negative thing, but it gives the balance and makes the colors even more bright. And I love what he said about your health. You appreciate your health more after you've been sick. Anybody disagree with that? Okay, not a hand. Good, awesome. You're proving our point here. That's great. You appreciate your health more after being sick or going through some sort of illness or having some sort of disorder. You long for those days when your health was what it used to be as you get older. It's in those negative things that we see the positive shine even more brightly. One other aspect that he looks at, I'm going to do a fun little exercise that may not translate to video or audio very well. We'll just see how that does, but you're here in the room. You get this benefit if they don't online, so take that, unless it's on there, and then you're welcome, I guess. He talks about this idea of dissonance and harmony. That's a musical term. So I'm going to move over here and show you what he's talking about. You're going to get to hear this in real time. I'm not going to play anything fancy. I'm just going to show you. If you don't know what dissonance is, we're going to give you an example of what that is, and you're going to hear what we're saying. So I'm just going to play two chords, just regular chords, and you're going to hear, it's just pleasing, okay? You hear that? It's just nice and pleasant, the harmony there. It's great. Now, I'm going to play a dissonant chord, and you're going to hear something different. Are you ready? You hear that difference? I just stay on that. What are you waiting for? You're waiting for it to resolve. Come on. You hear that? There it is. I resolve the dissonant chord. And so what happens is you hear in music the tension there. And that it's more of a dark, that's why you have those dissonant chords. It builds tension, it gives emotion to a song. There, you know, we're not done yet. I'm waiting, I'm on the edge of my seat for that chord to resolve to the end. That is how much of our life works. And we'll connect this at this point. We'll connect perfectly and dovetail in with the final point in a minute. But as we talked about last week in Romans, all creation groans. All creation in its broken state, post-Genesis 3 fall of man, sin entering the world, all creation is always on that dissonant chord all the time. Even the earth knows this is not how we were. The earth knows we were made a certain way, and they felt that fracture. This is not how it was designed to be, but that's how it is. And they're looking forward to when at the end of time, when God judges all sin and all things are made right and justice is fully and finally done, everything then will resolve. So they know there's something more. We know there's something more, and that's why we can see God even in the midst of suffering, sometimes even more clearly than in the good times. So that's a great principle to help us see our suffering as sanctifying in nature. Here's a second principle that we see in sanctifying suffering. Suffering creates and strengthens unique community. Suffering creates and strengthens unique community. A positive effect of suffering is it opens our eyes to what we might call shared humanity. Because sometimes in our success, we tend to isolate if we're not careful or even if we're not aware of it. You know, I'm too reliant when things are good, or I feel threatened by other people when things are good. If I get them involved, they might mess it up. If I, you know, I have a small business, if I add this team member, man, it's a big decision, because what if they come and wreck the whole thing? What if they embezzle money? What, you know, there's all these what ifs and all these negatives. And so in success, we tend to maybe feel like we're above other people who aren't as successful as we are or aren't doing as good as we are at the time. Even if it's subconsciously, there's this tendency to isolate in success. But suffering shows us how connected we are. There is really shared humanity. And it shows our need for one another. I need people, and people need me. Suffering helps us to see that. One term in sociology is this idea of pain as what they call social glue. Pain as social glue. So, for example, a funeral is going to bring a family together. And a lot of times what happens is in that time of grief, when we're all broken down, we're all sort of emotionally vulnerable, that's a time when, doesn't always happen, but it's a time when families can reconcile. They come together for a very sad reason, for a sad occasion, yet healing in the family for the next generation can then happen. It's this social glue that pain can be. Even think of the unity, almost 25 year coming up on the 25th anniversary of the attacks on 9/11. You remember, if you're old enough, and I'm old enough, okay, I am. I was in high school when this happened. But you remember the national unity for a while? I mean, immediately, we were attacked. I've never been to New York City. I've never been to Pennsylvania. I never met any person who was attacked on that day, but as an American, I felt attacked. We all felt that way. We were attacked. And so we had this national sense of unity, even through this social glue, this shared pain, as people who are connected in this community. And even spiritually, there was a bit of an uptick there for a while, and you know, then it went way, way down, like worse than it was before, and now it's maybe sort of on the uptick again. And so we see these times can have that effect. Even if you look in the book of Acts, the church, they grew, they flourished through suffering. Persecution brought them together. It was their social glue because they're like, we have no option. If we're going to survive, if we're going to make it, we've got to stick together. And so the suffering there is not, they're not looking for it, they're not asking for it, but as it comes, it actually brings them together. It creates this unique community and strengthens that unique community. Now, unfortunately for Job, he is not experiencing this. I added this in for our benefit, but also as a way to show you what Job is missing. Now, initially, when his friends, remember in chapters 1 and 2, when his friends hear about his situation, they come to visit him, so that's good. But ever since they've opened their mouth for the first time, he's like, could you please leave now? You know, it's like after 4 days, dead fish and, you know, visiting family start to smell. It's that sort of idea, you know. He's like, okay, you have not been of any help. Later on in Job, he'll call them miserable comforters, which is a weird, you know, oxymoronic term there. And so this community he does not have. He is on his own. Even his wife, as we looked at early on in the series, she's telling him, hey, just give up. Just curse God and die. Just be done. And we looked at different ways you can view that. But he's on an island. He's on his own. He does not have this. And so it is really a miracle that Job is able, even to this point, still make it, still survive, and still be looking for God. But this should strengthen that community. And so it should for us. Christian suffering should be a team sport. That's how it's designed to work. That's how you can withstand suffering, is you're on this team together. Galatians chapter 6, verse 2, Paul writes this in the New Testament. He says, share each other's burdens, and in this way, obey the law of Christ. The reality is, when things get heavy in my life, I need people who can be there to help carry the load. When others in the room, others in our faith family, when they are struggling and down, they need us to get around them and help them and bear their burdens, share their burdens. But what does that look like in our life? There's a couple scriptures we'll look at from Paul, and then one in the Old Testament, yeah. So in Romans 12, 15, Paul says it this way. Here's one way we can bear each other's burdens. Romans 12, 15, he says, be happy with those who are happy and weep with those who weep. Now, as we've already said, Job's friends have really done a terrible job of this. They see that their friend is down, but they're piling on. I think they feel they have good intentions. They think if we correct him and he repents, then God will now bless him. God will remove the suffering from him and the punishment from him, even though they're totally wrong. I think they're right, but they refuse to listen to Job, which is kind of revealing that they're just kind of stuck in their ways. And so we want to be happy with those who are happy and weep with those who are weep. But it's not just, oh, I feel bad for that person. That's good. Sympathy's good. Even empathy's good. But it's really more than that. So go with me back to Ecclesiastes, more wisdom literature from the Old Testament. It's a pretty classic passage. You'll probably recognize it here as we read it. But it gives us practical to-dos, things that we can physically do to help those that are suffering and in need. Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12, it says this. Two people are better off than one, for they can help each other succeed. If one person falls, the other can reach out and help. But someone who falls alone is in real trouble. Likewise, two people lying close together can keep each other warm, but how can one be warm alone? A person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer. Three are even better, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. There are actions that are taking place here, lifting people up, fighting alongside, or having someone's back, literally. And so what we want to look at is, what practical things can I do to be there for those who are suffering? Now, the answer to that question depends on the situation, obviously. It depends on the circumstance and the person, your relationship to them. But there are practical, physical things that we each can do to have that sort of social glue and that community for those who are suffering. And what I love about this local body is I feel like we do a really good job on that part, keeping up with each other, staying invested in each other's lives, that sort of thing. And so I'm preaching to the choir a little bit here, but just sort of encouraging us to continue doing those great things. Now, there is one challenge in this, and then we'll move on to the next practical tip here. As a form of encouragement and motivation, what we have to do is make this a consistent thing. Here's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 1, 3, and 4. He writes this: "All praise to God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Our God is our merciful Father and the source of all comfort. He comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort others. When they are troubled, we will be able to give them the same comfort God has given to us." So it is good, it is positive that I'm comforted in my time of need. It's good that God is my support, others are my support when I am suffering. But it should be reciprocal, right? It should just not be take in, but it should then be to give that out. So we want to keep that in our minds, that this is a consistent sort of life cycle type of thing. And it also implied there is the challenge to not revert back to isolationism when things are good again, but to continue to look out for others. Yeah, maybe my situation is better than theirs. It's not to be a point of pride. It's then I can resource them maybe even in a more healthy way because I'm in a good place. It's not that I have to feel threatened by somebody else and I don't want them to succeed as good as me or better than me, but it's like when they're down, we're going to pick them up. When they're fighting, we're going to join the fight with them. Two are better than one. Three is better than two. We're going to do this thing together in this unique, strong community through suffering. So the third principle here with sanctifying suffering is that suffering develops trust. Suffering develops trust. Again, despite all of Job's suffering that he is enduring, he continues to come back to God because he trusts him. Back to Job chapter 10, go down to verse 12, and look at what Job says in the middle of this. Verse 1, I loathe my life, right? But down to verse 12, he says this about God: "You gave me life and showed me your unfailing love. My life was preserved by your care." Look at what he's saying about God in the midst of extreme suffering. He knows it was God who gave him life. He knows that God is the one who has not failed him, your unfailing love. And he says it's preserved his life, God's care. And you look at Job's situation, he has no physical, obvious reason to react this way. But that's why he sees it as sanctifying suffering. It's doing something greater than I can understand. It's doing something deeper than I'm even aware of in the moment. I'm looking to God who gave me life, who's preserved my life, who doesn't fail me, who always cares for me. That's what this sanctifying suffering is all about. And this connection might seem strange, but Peter in the New Testament makes the exact same connection. And he gives us encouragement on that as well. So go back in the New Testament there, the end of the Bible there, to 1 Peter chapter 1. And Peter makes this connection as well. So let's look at it just for a second. 1 Peter 1, verses 6 through 9. Peter says weird things here. He says, "So be truly glad. There is wonderful joy ahead, even though you must endure many trials for a little while. These trials will show that your faith is genuine. It is being tested as fire tests and purifies gold, though your faith is far more precious than mere gold. So when your faith remains strong through many trials, it will bring you much praise and glory and honor on the day when Jesus Christ is revealed to the whole world." And then here's the part I want us to focus in on here. "You love him," that's God, "you love God even though you have never seen him. Though you do not see him now, you trust him, and you rejoice with a glorious and inexpressible joy. The reward for trusting him will be the salvation of your souls." So the wild thing about the Christian faith and the Christian life is what tends to be, what I think Peter is saying and what Job is showing us here is the more we suffer, the more we can and should trust God. Doesn't seem on the surface to make any sense at all, and yet it's consistently through the scriptures. Even Hebrews tells us that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. This faith thing is, you know, sort of flying blind. It's sort of this idea of, I don't know what's happening next. I don't know what's coming next. I don't know why what happened to me even happened to me yet, but I still trust God in all of that I don't understand. So that's what we see here. I'm going to quote now. A lot of quotes today, but I just want you to see kind of a well-rounded view of what we're talking about. A name that a lot of you in our small group will recognize, A.W. Tozer. Hey, you recognize that name? Hey, it's not the book that we're studying right now. It's a different work. It's called The Root of the Righteous. But in this work, I want to share with you two quotes that he shares here about the other side of trust. So what we're saying first is, suffering can lead to more trust in God from us. But there's also a different side of this trust. It goes the other way as well. It's not as fun or as pleasant, but it's very important. So here's what A.W. Tozer writes in The Root of the Righteous. He says this: it is necessary for God to use suffering to discipline and purify his people. It is doubtful whether God can bless a man greatly until he has hurt him deeply. Now that's really strong language there. But I can't really argue against it, okay? It comes back to what we've said previously in this series, that suffering is not punishment, it's a test, and those are different things. We don't see a teacher as evil for giving a test, that they're doing their job with their classroom. God is the same way. Whether he causes suffering or allows suffering, whatever way you want to look at that, it's the same idea. We are being tested in certain ways to see not just what I say I will do when times get tough, but now when times are tough, it shows me, reveals to me what I will do. It's not just what I say I believe when life is going just fine. It's what do I actually live out when things are not going fine. There's no other way to reveal that than through suffering. And so that's what he does here. It's more than theory. It's more than hypothetical. It is reality when suffering is there. And if Jesus is right, and he is, that we should expect suffering if we follow him, and we will, this is why Peter says we shouldn't see it as a strange thing, but instead we should embrace it. So a second quote from this same work by Tozer, a little bit longer, but catch what he's saying about how, I'll tell you the crux of it, and then we'll read the quote. So basically what he's going to say is, suffering is a way for God to see if he can trust us. Here's what he writes. The flaming desire of us to be rid of every unholy thing and to put on the likeness of Christ at any cost is not often found among us. We expect to enter the everlasting kingdom of our Father and to sit down around the table with sages, saints, and martyrs. And through the grace of God, maybe we shall. Yes, maybe we shall. But for the most of us, it could prove at first an embarrassing experience. Ours might be the silence of the untried soldier in the presence of the battle-hardened heroes who have fought the fight and won the victory and who have the scars to prove that they were present when the battle was joined. Do you see what he's saying there? It's like, I don't want to be embarrassed when I get to heaven and all the stuff that I complained about that was meaningless or silly, and I'm sitting next to like a saint who was beheaded in the 4th century. Those stories are not the same. That suffering is not equal. And so what God does is he tests us through suffering to see how he can trust us in life. That may not sound, you know, very PC, but I don't see how you can argue against that. The question is, can God trust me? Well, I hope so. But the other question is, how do I know? It has to come through suffering. The only way I can be proven is through suffering. Now, I will say this. I'm not going to go out of my way to seek suffering out, okay? I'm just not going to do that. Yes, God, please bring it on. Not necessarily, okay? No one's going to do that. But the point is, not that I'm asking for it, the point is it's going to come in some form or another at some point. And so it's not am I looking for it, it's like when it comes, how will I respond? Will I give up on this whole faith thing because I can't see what God's doing in the middle of this? It's not going to show, you know, much trust that God can have with me if that's my response. Now, again, we're going to struggle. We're humans. We're frail. We have emotions. And yes, we're going to, like Job, he cries and he laments and he wants to be dead for half of this book. But yet he's still there. He's still pushing. He's still living. He's still asking. He's still believing in the same God, even though he feels all this weight on top of him. That is sanctifying suffering. That is what this is all about. Can God truly trust me? And how do I know? It's got to come through, unfortunately, suffering. But it builds that trust. Here's the fourth point here. The fourth principle of sanctifying suffering is this. Suffering reveals to us God is who he claims to be. Suffering reveals to us God is who he claims to be. So last week we argued that God is great and God is good. And so just as we just talked about, just as suffering tests us, suffering also tests God in a way where he can show himself to be faithful. Again, if there's no test, how do we know how good God is? Again, it compares the good and evil. If evil is only the deprivation or the corruption of the good, it's the same thing with suffering. How am I ever going to know how good life can be if I never suffer? How then can I know how good God can really be if I never suffer? If I never have to endure anything hard, my faith is not really necessary at all. But that's not the way it works, fortunately. Let's go back to, we'll look at Job, three quick verses here, back to back to back. These last two points are pretty short. So in Job 9, verse 10, back to Job 9, in this section here together, here's how Job describes God, like we looked at it last week. He says, God does great things beyond searching out and marvelous things beyond number. I keep repeating myself here, but you have to see this. You have to see this theme. Despite all the suffering of Job, he still declares the greatness of God. We cannot overstate that. I mean, I could say it over and over, and I'm not going to say it enough because we need to hear it. I need to hear it. When suffering hits me right between the eyes, when the worst thing you could ever imagine happening to you actually happens, God is still great. Job declares that in Job 9, verse 10. Let's skip down to Job chapter 4 again. In Job chapter 10, verse 4, Job asks, this is a rhetorical question, but here's what he asks to God. Have you eyes of flesh? Do you see as man sees? The answer to those is obviously no. We already declared God is great. He's above. He is other than we are. But he's asking, he's sort of doing this to build his own faith. Okay, God, I get it. You're bigger than me. You're greater than me. And that's sort of the next point that kind of goes together. So, and then down in verse 13 of Job 10, Job says this, yet these things you hid in your heart. I know that this was your purpose. Again, the otherness of God is being acknowledged here. What Job is really saying here is, even with the, do you have eyes of flesh? Do you see as man sees and God having a heart? What he's saying is, God has made me in his image, not the other way around. Sometimes we miss-see suffering because we think that God owes me something or that God has to do this. But no, I'm made in his image, not the other way around. And Job believes in God's sovereignty. God sees things that I do not see. God sees things that I cannot see. Because I'm not eternal. I can't see time, the whole span of time at one point above time. I can't do that. So God sees what I do not see and what I cannot see. And as Job declares here, God always has a greater purpose than I'm aware. Always. Isaiah, you know, it says God, his thoughts are higher than ours. His ways are greater than ours. Job is saying the same thing here. He says, you've hit it. What's going on? And that was your purpose. But you don't see the things the way that I see them. You don't see things the way that I do. And so that's the final, or that's the fourth principle here of sanctifying suffering, is just releasing those things to God. Being okay with not being in complete control. Being okay with God having things hidden from us that we can't see, reasons that he has that we might never know. Sanctifying suffering pushes through those unknowns and trusts him all the more anyway. Then here's the final point as we start to wrap it up. The final thing that maybe this is the most motivating one, I kind of saved it for last for that reason, is this. Remember, this is not all there is. This is not all there is. So Job has not really overtly said this yet, but his attitude shows this is his heart. He knows there is more to all of this than I can see. There is a larger plan here. God is up to something behind the scenes, cosmically in the heavens, it's just bigger. There's more than what I can see here. This is not all there is. Remembering that is going to help us to look up and look forward, and hopefully will be a great source of hope as we endure suffering. And so let me give you a couple more quotes as we close that hopefully will practically minister to you. So the great 20th century Welsh pastor, Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, he wrote this. He says this, let us not therefore be stumbled when we see surprising things happening in the world. Rather, let us ask, what is the relevance of this event to the kingdom of God? Or, if strange things are happening to you personally, don't complain, but say, what is God teaching me through this? We need not become bewildered and doubt the love or the justice of God. We should judge every event in the light of God's great, eternal, and glorious purpose. What Dr. Lloyd-Jones here is reminding us is that God always plays the long game. God is doing things generationally, and we're worried about, like, this week on the calendar. He's always playing the long game. This mindset for us is so crucial, because what it will do is it will keep us from seeing everything bad happening to us as a conspiracy. The world's out to get me. No. God has a bigger plan. This is not all there is. There's more that's happening than I can see. It will keep us from being chronic complainers about every little thing all the time. There's something bigger, something better. It will keep us from giving into hopelessness and despair. There's a master plan at work, even if I can't see it. So we become aware that our lives are part of this bigger plan. So we might ask, and it's okay to ask this, you might ask in your suffering, why me? But that's not the only question you ask. If that's the only question you ask in suffering, it's going to be way more miserable than it could be. You can ask that, but also what he's saying here is also what we should ask is not just why me, but what now? God, what are you doing with this? You have a purpose for everything. Like, even the appendix, God, you have a purpose for that. You know, even gnats, you have a purpose for a gnat. I don't know what it is. I can't explain it, but there's a purpose. So God has a purpose for everything, even and maybe especially the suffering that we face. That's the epitome of sanctifying suffering. That's what it is. Let me give you one more example of this as we close. You've probably heard of her story, but if not, I got a picture here of Johnny Erickson Tada. So in 1967, at age 17, she had a diving accident. And in one moment, this soon-to-be, you know, going to college with her life in front of her is now quadriplegic, losing the use of her hands and her arms and legs. So she's in, obviously, intense, she survives, but she's in intense, you know, therapy for months and months and years. And she even writes in one of her works that she had the desire to take her own life, but not the physical ability to do so. If she had the ability to do so, she would have killed herself 50 years ago. But she said, that's almost like a blessing from God that she wasn't able to physically. But as she's going through this rehab, she discovers she has this hidden talent she never knew she had. She puts a paintbrush in her teeth and paints these beautiful pieces of artwork. And so in the coming years, as this kind of takes off, our story becomes well-known. You've probably heard of her, you know, for years and years. So in the 50 years since this accident, she's written over 40 books. She's hosted a nationally syndicated radio show. She's spoken all over the world, and she's encouraged millions and millions of people on what sanctifying suffering can look like. And so here is how she describes, in her work, When God Weeps, her own sanctifying suffering. Listen to what she says. God cares most not about making us comfortable, but about teaching us to hate our sins, grow up spiritually, and love him. To do this, he gives us salvation's benefits only gradually, sometimes painfully gradually. In other words, he lets us continue to feel much of sin's sting while we're headed for heaven, where at last, every sorrow we taste will one day prove to be the best possible thing that could have happened. She understands sanctifying suffering. She sees this is not all there is. Our ultimate hope is there is a life that is yet to come. And here's what Paul tells us about that. Romans 8:18, Paul says, yet what we suffer now is nothing compared to the glory he will reveal to us later. One day soon, I don't know when it will be, and I'm sorry that we have to face suffering and pain now. I wish it weren't that way, but it is. But our hope, our motivation is that one day we will be in a place forever where there is no more pain or suffering or sadness or tears or crime or sickness, none of that. And that is forever with no end. That's why Paul says our suffering now is temporary. It seems like in the middle of it, this is never going to end. But one day it will all end. This is not all there is. That is our hope in our sanctifying suffering. We can see God. We can trust God. He can trust us. We have one another to endure this suffering as we anticipate the home that is yet to come where suffering is no more. This is how we practically live out our sanctifying suffering. Let's pray as we close today. God, in this series, we've talked a lot about suffering, and it might seem like an overload, but that's what this whole book of Job is all about. It's teaching us, it's showing us this man's suffering to an extreme degree to help us as we endure suffering. God, we don't look for suffering, but in a strange way, you know, we thank you for it, that you're proving us, that you're testing us, and that we can see you in the middle of that. And what we see here, the pain, the sin, the disorder that we see and live in and live with here will show us in the life to come how good that life is going to be. God, you are great and you are good, as we talked about the last couple of weeks, and we thank you that even our suffering can be seen as sanctifying. It's doing something greater than we can see. It's doing more than we are aware that it's doing. We see you even clearer in those moments of darkness because you're so bright, you're so good. And so we don't look for it, but we thank you that you're with us in it. We thank you that you have a plan and a purpose that is greater than our minds can comprehend. And our hope is that we will be with you one day in a place of perfect peace. And so we look forward to that, and we believe that, and we live that out even today in the middle of what we're suffering through in the moment. God, I pray a blessing over everybody here today. You'd be with them this week, whether they're on a high or a low, whether they're suffering or not, that you'd be with us, lead us, guide us, carry us through all that life has for us this coming week, and bring us back next time ready for more of you. In Jesus' name, amen.